Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama signing the health care reform bill today, but the challenges keep coming. A dozen states and counting now say they'll invoke their rights and fight a national law they don't like. States' rights is beginning to look like the next big thing in American politics. On health care, guns, marijuana, you name it. This hour on Point, the sudden states' rights push and what it means for health care reform and these United States. You can join the conversation. Is talk of states' rights in the air where you live? And over what? Health care reform, guns, marijuana, gay rights. Is this proof our democracy is still vigorous, or is it off-key, a fraying of national unity and authority? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Reed Wilson. He's editor of Hotline on Call, a political blog of the National Journal. Reed, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's going on with all these state-level challenges to the new national, signed today law on health care reform?
Well, starting with the health care reform itself, it looks like at least 13 states' attorneys general are going to be filing a lawsuit at some point today challenging the constitutionality of this health care reform bill that was passed on Sunday night. The reform effort, it's led by folks like Bill McCollum in Florida, Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia, several attorneys general who looks like actually have their eyes on larger office. At some point in their careers. The bill remains very unpopular with the American public, and this is a way that Republicans can keep it on the front burner and use this as an effective political tool.
You say remains very unpopular, and you're basing that on?
Well, there are several polls that have come out over the last couple of days, polls that show that the American public does not find the entire bill popular. There are aspects of this bill that are very popular and that the Democrats are going to run on, and Democrats are going to try to talk up over the next couple of months. But at the moment, this large reform notion is not something that's very popular. And this goes to sort of the larger point of folks all around the country seeing Washington as the enemy and essentially trying to reassert their Tenth Amendment rights.
Certainly in some parts of the country, what states, what attorneys general in what states have stepped up to say we'll join a suit against this?
Well, there are 13 states in total, everybody from Michigan, Washington, Virginia, Nebraska, Alabama, Florida, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, and Colorado as well. So there may be a few more. The attorney general of Oklahoma is a Democrat. He had expressed some reservations about this, about the bill in the first place. He is apparently reviewing the legislation. The Attorney General in Alaska is reviewing the legislation, and several governors, Republican governors, have asked their attorneys general to file to join this lawsuit.
Now, Reed, among these 13 who have put their hands up to join, are all these attorneys general Republicans?
They are indeed, every single one of them.
So what does it mean? How does it proceed? Is one state going to lead in this? Do they deputize someone to actually make the case? How does it work?
Well, it's not entirely clear how the lawsuit will be filed at some point today. Florida Governor Bill McCollum has been especially outspoken. I'm sorry, Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum has been especially outspoken on this. He has a press conference this afternoon in which he will sort of lay out the next steps.
And are they saying that the federal government does not have the right to ask the measures in the reform bill, or that the measures themselves are unconstitutional?
Well, it's a little bit of both. It's the federal government, they will say the federal government does not have the right to require states to do certain to pay for certain things, these unfunded mandates, as they call them, and that other things, the requirement that folks buy their own health care insurance or be penalized is unconstitutional. There's a two-pronged approach here. The White House is not terribly concerned about these particular lawsuits, but still, it's yet another way that Republicans are trying to challenge this bill, even after it passed the House.
And the White House is not concerned because?
Well, they say that that these kinds of challenges have been fought before, and the federal government usually comes out on top thanks to Article 6 of the Constitution.
So we've got 13 Article 6, which is about central
federal
authority.
Yeah, federal authority, mm-hmm. outranking states authority.
So we've got 13 putting their hands up, Republican attorneys generals to join this. Talk of legislation in opposition to the reform in several dozen other states. I've heard 34, 36, 37, a lot.
Yeah, the National Conference of State Legislatures puts the number at 36 states have introduced measures to limit in some way the federal bill. 29 states are going after some kind of constitutional amendment. Another 13 states are pursuing some changes to state law, so obviously some states are trying both tactics there. Already there is a constitutional amendment that's going to be on the ballot in Arizona in the fall. Colorado, some activists are collecting signatures for a ballot measure that might make it on the ballot as well.
But, of course, in many of these states, all it takes is a Republican or two to say we want to do something, and they become part of the number. It doesn't necessarily mean something will happen in these legislatures.
That's right, Tom. This is at the end of the day, I don't think it's likely that a lot of these states pass reform bills. Several states have already defeated them, including some pretty heavily Republican states, places like Wyoming, South Dakota, Indiana as well. New Mexico and New Hampshire and Mississippi have also defeated bills, although their state legislatures are more tilted towards Democrats.
Now, Reid, the health care reform package has led opponents to pick this bullhorn up in a big way just now. But states' rights push didn't begin yesterday. In recent year, we've seen other fronts on which it's been pushed.
That's right. I think the first time that we really saw a new concentration on the 10th Amendment was back on April 15th, 2009. That was the day of the first major Tea Party marches around the country. You might remember a bunch of folks getting together talking about the federal stimulus bill and how concerned they were about the amount of federal spending. Governor Rick Perry of Texas got in front of a microphone at the state capitol in Austin, mm-hmm. and seemed to suggest, although he'll back away from it now, seemed to suggest that that Texas might even secede from the Union. He talked about the 10th Amendment a lot, and that was sort of how it was interpreted by those sort of Tea Party crowds. That began a larger push on the right, and funny enough, the push on the left has been going on for quite a while, largely around things like medical marijuana use
in California. Remember, yeah,
California and Oregon both mm-hmm. Both have dealt with federal agents coming into to their states, and even though they've got medical marijuana laws, federal agents coming in and arresting those who are participating in medical marijuana. So it's this 10th Amendment thing is by no means unique to today, but we definitely have seen a flare-up over the last year.
Some states' rights push on the gay marriage front, on environmental fronts, on the calling out of the National Guard. Some resistance there, Rhode Island, Vermont, Wisconsin, during the Bush years, wanting to say no thanks to the continuous call-up of the Guard.
That's right. We've seen this push now for the last couple of years. I mean, I really think the Tea Party movement has put the most emphasis behind it. You keep hearing Republican politicians talking about the 10th Amendment, sort of insinuating that secession may be an idea.
What a thing to be in the air in 2010. Reid Wilson at Hotline on Call. Reid, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom.
I want to bring two big scholars and minds on this into our conversation right now. From Durham, North Carolina, Neil Siegel joins us. He's professor of law and political science at Duke University. Neil Siegel, thank you very much for being here.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And from Auburn, Alabama, Thomas Woods joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. It's a libertarian think tank. Mr. Woods, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Neil Siegel, first to you, what do you see going on in this state-level opposition to a reform package that was just passed about, 36 hours ago?
Well, I think it's important to begin with a distinction, a distinction between talking about federalism, by which I mean the appropriate balance of power between the federal government and the states, mm-hmm. on the one hand, and talk of states' rights and nullification and secession, which either intentionally or unwittingly evokes some very powerful historical and cultural memories of Southern opposition to federal regulation of slavery before the Civil War, Southern opposition to Brown against Board of Education and school desegregation during what legal scholars call the Second Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question I would have is, why is entirely appropriate talk about the limits of federal power and the appropriate circumstances and ways in which states should be pushing back against federal power when state officials think that it's being used in a way that's misguided,
mm-hmm.
why is that being couched in terms of the 10th Amendment, nullification, secession, and why is it being couched in those terms now? It's not as if we didn't see a huge expansion of federal power during the previous administration, the second President Bush. If you think about the prescription drug legislation, No Child Left Behind, a federal ban, a national ban on a controversial method of abortion, right? Conservatives mm-hmm. long said that abortion should be decided by the states. If you think about the difficult to put into words the amount of American blood and treasure that has been spilled in Iraq. People talk about the cost of health care, right? So why is it that this talk about the 10th Amendment and states' rights is happening now?
We're going to look at the details of that, but let me ask if I may, because we've got a break coming right up here. Thomas Woods, in just a half a minute, what's your answer to that? Why do you think we see this push now? Is it because of the scale of the health care reform bill itself or something else?
That's partly that some people aren't principled and that, you know, they'll support central power when it favors them and they'll support states' rights when that favors them. We just need to get more principled people who support decentralization in the Jeffersonian tradition as Jefferson would have wanted, consistently across the board, whether or not it's their issue. Sure, Vermont might wind up being different from Alabama, but that's what the U.S. was supposed to be. Let Vermont be Vermont, for heaven's sake.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the sudden states' rights push and what it means for health care reform and more around this country. Neil Siegel is with us. He's a professor of law and political science at Duke University. He joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Thomas E. Woods is here. He's senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. It's a libertarian think tank. His forthcoming book on states' rights is called Nullification. Neil, Thomas, we've got a lot of response here already. Here from Facebook, Alfred says, perhaps our country is too large for an effective hegemony. A peaceful secession of a number of states might make for a better society. Debbie says there has to be some umbrella-like consistency of American life at the federal level. Otherwise, our national identity can be lost. And Tim says, it feels to me like there are rumblings of another North-South schism here. What about on its merits, Neil? I mean, they do happen to be all Republican attorneys general at the moment, but you know, there is opposition to this legislation. Do you see it as a legitimate exercise in a federalist context, if you like, to say, wait a minute, we want to challenge the legality of this big new federal package?
I think it's entirely legitimate for people to be opposed to health care reform, right? People are entitled mm-hmm. to their own views. I think it's more questionable whether it's appropriate to couch those concerns in the language of states' rights. In other words, is it your substantive political opposition to health care reform, or is it a principled commitment to decentralization? It seems to me that there aren't a lot of principled folks out there when they talk about states' rights. They're very much in favor of robust federal power when it suits them, and then they couch their concerns against a particular exercise of federal power in the deceptive procedural dress of federalism. So again, I think it's legitimate to be opposed to this. I think it's more questionable if you're not saying what you mean and meaning what you say, right? What exactly is it? What constitutional principles of federalism exactly are we talking about that render this legislation unconstitutional, particularly because it's impossible for the states, it seems to me, or very, very difficult for the states acting on their own to tackle the problem.
Well, the one that's raised, Tom Woods, I'll put it to you first. The one that's raised is the portion of the health care reform that would mandate individuals to buy health insurance. Now, of course, dynamically, that's if you're going to cover everybody, you kind of need everybody to have insurance. That's the only way to make it all, you know, balance out and pay for itself. But that's where the opposition's coming, as I understand it. People saying, what right do you have to require individuals in my state to buy insurance?
Well, on this question, of course, you know, anybody who's a modern law professor is going to laugh at the idea that there might be limits on something like this. But if we care about the Constitution as drafted, and as even Alexander Hamilton said, until it has been formally amended, it still retains the original meaning. The state ratifying conventions repeatedly used the words expressly delegated. Even the word expressly isn't even in the Tenth Amendment. They were sold the Constitution on the idea that implicit in it was the idea that the federal government has only those powers expressly delegated. This view is shared all over the place. Virginia would not have come into the Union. Other states would not have come into the Union on these grounds. If you said to them, well, you know what, the Constitution next week might mean something completely different and we might find a whole reservoir of additional powers, no one would have ratified this thing. But, Tom, I think it's very important for me to have a chance to respond to something Professor Siegel said, because there is a big push on now to demonize these ideas of nullification and suppose that they are associated with slavery and oppression. This is what everybody is taught in the country. But the fact is, Thomas Jefferson came up with this idea that the states have to have some defense mechanism against a federal government out of control. This idea was used by the New England states in the 19th century, in history that has been completely forgotten. The New England states used these principles to defy Jefferson's embargo, to defy the calling up of the militia to invade Canada during the War of 1812, to preemptively resist any military conscription bill that might be passed by the federal government, to prevent the federal government from enlisting minors against the will of their parents, and indeed to fight against slavery. In Wisconsin, anti-slavery activists cited nullification, Thomas Jefferson, and yes, even the hated John C. Calhoun. Apparently nobody bothered to tell them that if you cite Calhoun, you're a wicked slavery supporter. They were anti-slavery activists who argued they were unconstitutional aspects of the fugitive slave laws, and they weren't going to support them.
Are you making the case then that this is a legitimate and correct push by states right now on healthcare reform? Or I thought you began by saying law professors would laugh at the idea.
Well, law professors would. I mean, I'm sure present company accepted, but most law professors know a lot of cases. They don't know any American history. They don't know the ratifying conventions. And so I think, sure, their view is Article 6 settles the question. No, it doesn't. Article 6 begs the question.
Neil Siegel, what do you say to that, Neil?
Let's start with the Constitution as originally drafted. So when the Constitutional Convention meets in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, the convention instructs the Midsummer Committee of Detail, which is charged with drafting Congress's powers in Article 1, Section 8, that Congress should have the power to legislate when the states are separately incompetent, when the states face problems they can't adequately handle on their own. Health insurance and an individual mandate to possess health insurance is a textbook example in economics of a problem that the states can't handle on their own.
Cannot.
There's a reason why only one state has tried it. Imagine some states have it and other states don't. So then you have people who are sick and unhealthy going to the states who have it, and all the premiums of citizens in those states go up. All the healthy people in those states go to other states. Mm-hmm. The insurers only want to do business in states that don't have the mandate, right? How could states acting on their own handle this, right? This is exactly the kind of problem that the framers charged the Committee of Detail with giving the federal government the power to solve.
If this actually goes to the courts, do you see, and looking at our conservative Supreme Court now, do you see the courts upholding a state-level challenge to this law or not?
I do not. I don't think it's just law professors. I don't think it's just law professors who would balk at this. Justice Kennedy, Justice Scalia, putting aside the four justices who are characterized as liberals, right? They believe in broad federal power, right? They upheld the federal government's power to regulate medical marijuana in the Raich case. And when you start talking about nullification and secession, right, you're not going to get one vote on the Supreme Court for that. And I don't see any place in the Constitution
Governor Perry in Texas kind of made a passing reference to secession, but I don't really hear people talking secession. I mean, I know that's, you know, Gail Collins wrote in the New York Times not long ago, she wrote, the trick in conservative circles today is to see how furious you can get about Washington's encroachment onto states' rights without quite falling over the edge into Fort Sumter. Okay, but I don't really hear these attorneys general saying, we're out of here.
Right, but you do hear nullification. This is something we debated before the Civil War. It's something we debated in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education. You're not going to get one vote on the Supreme Court of the United States in 2010 for the proposition that the states have power to nullify federal laws. You might have arguments that the federal law itself is not valid and therefore not supreme under the Supremacy Clause of Article 6, mm-hmm. right? But tell me where the nullification clause is in the Constitution. And if you want to say the 10th Amendment, then I would suggest we do what conservatives are always criticizing liberals for not doing, which is read the language of the 10th Amendment.
Well, let's read it right here. 10th Amendment says, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." We've got a lot of the people calling in. I want to go to them. Lake City, South Carolina. Caesar. Caesar, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you all doing?
We're fine. What do you see?
I've been listening intently. I live here under the dominion of the Attorney General Henry McMaster. And it's almost laughable to see him on television screaming about states' rights. And I wasn't alive during the 50s and 60s, but I've read enough and seen enough that when I hear politicians screaming states' rights, particularly Southern politicians, it just doesn't bode well for the well-being of all the citizens. It's clear that that Attorney General McMaster is running for governor, and this is a way for him to distinguish himself amongst the gubernatorial pack for the GOP nomination. But I just think that this whole talk of nullification and secession is just ludicrous in the 21st century.
But, Caesar, are they really, really talking secession? Are you really hearing that in South Carolina?
I am hearing it in South Carolina. I am seeing the don't tread on me flags. I am seeing all of these things. And I got to tell you, the climate has really changed. But my thing is this. If you want to secede from the federal government, then what happens when the next hurricane comes here, Carolina, and we don't have the money to pay for it, to deal with the whole reconstruction of the state, or to help people who've been hurt as a result of the hurricane.
Caesar, we hear it. We've got a lot more callers. Let me get to some. Thank you. Sarah in Savannah, Georgia. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. It seems that the federal government spends an awful lot of money on health care, and therefore it seems like it would have the right to then require health insurance the same way that that car insurance by states is required. It just makes sense that with the amount of money the federal government has to spend on health care, it makes sense to that we'd be able to then require health insurance.
Everybody into the pool. But Thomas Woods, what about, even if it's not a nullification path here, I mean, it may simply be a challenge to the constitutionality of the mandate requirement itself.
Sure. And of course, the argument that, well, gee, the federal courts would never uphold this, that was precisely Thomas Jefferson's point. Thomas Jefferson emphasized repeatedly the federal courts are a branch of the federal government. So if you're going to say that we've got a dispute between the states and the federal government, let's have the federal government decide it. I mean, if you and I are having a dispute and I refer it to my cousin, you immediately know the deck is stacked. So his argument was the states are the constituent parts of the union, so therefore they have to make their interpretation of the Constitution count for something. And the fact is, this is not a North-South thing. Tom, as you pointed out at the beginning, this is all over the country. And the fact is, the left used to favor, you know, before they became, bureaucratizing freaks, they used to favor decentralization. Kirkpatrick Sale wrote his wonderful book in the 60s called Human Scale. And he said, everything has gotten too big in this society. Economic structures, political structures. Right now, in 1790, we had one representative for every 30,000 people. Now we have one for every 710,000.
But what about Neil's argument that you can't solve the health care challenge without everybody getting into the pool here, without all the states in on it?
Whether that's true or not, Jefferson's view, and I take the Jeffersonian tradition to be sort of normative, would be that you amend the Constitution to grant the federal government the disputed power. You do not simply say, well, gosh, this would be terribly inconvenient. Well, there's no way we can do this, so therefore let's just go ahead and do it without an amendment. The fact is that, as I say, the states would never have – I mean, certainly Virginia. If you look at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, there's no way. I mean, this is a home run. There's no way they would have – Patrick Henry said – this general welfare clause will allow them to do anything they want. This clause will allow them to do anything they want. And they were assured by supporters of the Constitution that the federal government would have only those powers expressly delegated to it, and if it attempted to go beyond those powers, the people who drafted the ratification instrument for Virginia said Virginia will be exonerated from any additional power exercise. Now, that's what the ratifiers were themselves told. That's significant. I didn't make this up.
We'll dig on in on what's going on right now. Lots of response here. Web comment, Brian says, I thought we settled the nullification issue with the death of 700,000 Americans in the 1860s and the liberation of 4.2 million slaves. Lark says, why aren't states' rights proponents opting out of Medicare? Let's go to Elena in New York, Queens. Hi, Elena. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Very interesting discussion today. I guess I have a few points that I want to make, and I'll try to be brief. I think what greatly disturbs me and probably a lot of other Americans are the violations of inequality of law and process. Several things. Obama said that the American people don't really care how this was done just so long as the results were yielded. In other words, that he has put his agenda forward and that we should all be very happy about that.
Well, I mean, of course, there can be complaints about process, but there could be complaints in many periods. What about the states' rights point here, or federalism, Elena?
My states' rights point in that is that if we are to follow the law, then they need to follow it also. In other words, Pelosi basically told us, sign it to find out what's in it. Here, put your name on it, and you're going to be legally responsible for this. And the American people say, what's in this? Will you give us like 72 hours to read this? We don't understand the legalese. They continue to put things in here that don't make any sense, that don't really relate to the health care issue. The American people say, we don't like this. In other words, if a policeman comes to your door, they knock on your door, and they say, I think you have drugs here. They come in your house, they find drugs.
Elena, let's stick with health care. Does that mean you'd like New York to opt out if it would?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know what? As far as the Medicare, I'd like them to opt out of that also, because most of the American people aren't getting it. At least in New York, they're not.
Well, there may come a time when you feel differently, but I hear you right now, Elena. Neil, you know, there's a lot of sentiment out there that these attorneys general are riding. You hear it right there from Elena in Queens.
Yeah, and again, I wanted to distinguish opposition, people who think that it's unwise as a policy matter to have this legislation. I think many others would disagree with that. I want to distinguish that from the constitutional question. Is this within the scope of Congress's power to tax and spend? Is it within the scope of the commerce power? And, you know, on the law, if you care to get into it, mm-hmm. I think the law is very strongly on the side of the legislation. A whole separate question is, do states have the constitutional authority to opt out or nullify if they choose? And again, I would ask, where in the Constitution does that authority lie? It's not the 10th Amendment. And where does the logic of the argument end? Can states decide that they're going to opt out of American foreign policy, that states are going to opt out of certain alliances with certain countries as opposed to others?
Do you know if these attorneys general are challenging as an infringement of states' rights, or are they claiming that the bill itself is unconstitutional on its merits?
The rhetoric is of states' rights, mm-hmm. but you need to actually have a constitutional claim, and there's no freestanding states' rights claim. And so the argument I'm hearing is that it's beyond the scope of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, which is Clause 3 of Article mm-hmm. 1, Section 8. But the first thing I would say in response to that is Congress doesn't even need the Commerce Clause to support this legislation, because they've got the taxing power. The mandate is deceptive because it's actually framed as a tax, as a penalty, a financial penalty on those who don't comply with the law. And so you could use the tax power. And I can't remember the last time the court struck down something as beyond the tax power. And then when you get to the commerce power, you're talking about economic decisions whether to purchase insurance according to the law or self-insure. These are economic activities that the modern court, including the conservatives, have upheld.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the sudden states' rights push and what it means for healthcare reform and the country. Neil Siegel is with us, professor of law and political science at Duke University. Thomas Woods is here, joins us from Auburn, Alabama. He's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. It's a libertarian think tank. Let's go to Billy in Glasgow, Kentucky. Hi, Billy. You're on the air.
Hello. I guess I just had some comments on a while ago. I heard one of the guys say that why the states weren't concerned whenever Bush went to war with Iraq and some of the things that he pushed.
Yeah.
And I guess the biggest point that I had is all that he did, maybe people didn't agree with it, but it was constitutional. And I don't agree that this is constitutional, I guess.
But what if law scholars say it is? Where does that what does that leave us?
What do you mean if law scholars say it is?
Well, both of my guests today are saying, you know, the law scholars who study the law and court decisions over decades would say, well, this falls within the reach of the law.
I guess my point on that mm-hmm. is that the men that wrote the Constitution were men of genius that knew what freedom was. And I'm not a man of genius, but I know what freedom is. And when someone tells me that I have to buy something or get a penalty from it for not doing it, there's something that ticks inside me that says that's not freedom. And I'm not a scholar on the Constitution, but I know for sure that I don't care if men of law for the last 200 years have decided what was constitutional or not. It doesn't mean that they can't be wrong. And I keep hearing that that we elected Obama to do what we wanted to do. Well, we elected Bush to do what we wanted to do, and things came up. But the biggest thing we elect him to do is to uphold the Constitution, in my opinion.
Billy, we've got it. Thank you. Neil Siegel, what do you say to our caller from Glasgow?
I would need to hear more about why this bill is unconstitutional and right why he feels that.
Well, I said nobody should be able to tell him what he has to buy.
So then would it be I don't hear anyone arguing that it would be unconstitutional for the states to require people to purchase health insurance.
No, of course.
But that's a different question, right? I mean, that's the whole question here. This is a national program.
But his language sounds in mm-hmm. individual freedom and liberty.
I see, yeah.
And if that's the claim, then the states wouldn't be able to do it either. So again, you know, to simply assert that the framers were men of genius and to assert that this is unconstitutional, right, is a statement of a conclusion. I would need to hear more about why the statute is unconstitutional. I can explain to you two independent ways in which the statute is constitutional and in which I'm very likely to have majority support, not just among law professors, but among jurists.
And what about of the sitting Supreme Court? Do you think you'd have majority support there?
I do. Not just Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor, but Justice Kennedy as well, and possibly, again, some of the conservatives. No justice is going to say states can opt out to otherwise valid federal law. I mean, no one is going to make that argument. The question is this valid federal law? And then they'd have to just not just strike down this law, but radically change existing jurisprudence concerning the tax power and concerning the Commerce Clause in order to strike this down.
Let's go to Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and Richard. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi. Two thoughts. One is that callers and one of the guests keeps invoking Jefferson and the Jeffersonian tradition and his ideas and the genius of the founders, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of acknowledgement that the founders, like Hamilton, profoundly disagreed with Jefferson. So among the founders, there was a huge debate, and particularly the guest who keeps invoking Jefferson is overlooking the fact that when he was president, for example, Jefferson himself did lots of things like the Louisiana Purchase and the Embargo Act, which were, at the time, of dubious constitutionality. So it seems to me that we're setting up false lines of argument here.
Thomas Woods, I guess that comes to you.
Yeah, sure. Well, Jefferson's not infallible. That's why the presidency is such a dangerous office. The Louisiana Purchase, incidentally, almost all Republicans were of the belief that that was constitutional under the treaty power. It was only Jefferson, actually, who really had the constitutional scruples there. So that's a secondary issue. But interestingly, how did the New England states deal with the embargo that was of dubious constitutionality? They nullified it. Oh, heaven's sake. Oh, my goodness. The earth suddenly broke free of its axis and went spinning toward the sun. Now, the fact is that Hamilton, it's true, did have disagreement with Jefferson. But before the Constitution was ratified, Hamilton was saying in the Federalist, oh, no, the federal government won't have authority over agriculture because of the General Welfare Clause. Then after the Constitution is safely ratified, he says, of course it has authority over agriculture. So Hamilton, you have to take with a bit of grain of salt. And if I'm going to argue that Hamilton has just as good grounds to be listened to as Jefferson, then I guess we should also listen to Hamilton, who said the British had the best government in the world. We should come to emulate it. We should have a president that serves for life. We should have senators chosen by the president, governors chosen by the president. We should abolish the states. I mean, you know, if that's the position, we ought to use troops against the people. I mean, you know, if that's where you want to go, then by all means invoke Hamilton. But Jefferson is referring to the Virginia Ratification Convention. And at that convention, it was spelled out very clear as you could ask for, that Virginia was only delegating the expressly mentioned powers and that it would be exonerated from any additional power grabs on the part of the federal government. In Republican theory, small r Republican, that view of the ratifiers is far more important than anything else, because this is what people thought they were approving when they ratified the Constitution.
Going way, way back there, and that is, of course, the origin. Augusta, Georgia. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I would like your guest, if possible, could respond to this idea. I think there's an elephant in the room that we are trying to avoid mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
All of this has to do, I think, with primarily with who's in the White House. And on every bill that the Obamas have set forth, he has not had bipartisan support. And I know we're talking the jobs bill, that was a small bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. But in every bill he has set forth, he has mainly had resistance from Republicans. Now, this has a lot to do with him being his race and also with civil rights. And I think the Tenth Amendment that they are using as a clause to identify, get secession from the union, secession from the states, etc., I don't think it's all about that. I primarily think it's about we don't want Obama to succeed. Just as DeMint said from South Carolina, this could be Obama's Waterloo,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I think is forcing them to do what they're doing. It's inconceivable that you would take health care from a child when a child needs health care and the insurance companies are not allowing the child to have health care because of a pre-existing condition.
Robert, I'm glad you raised the issue. You could well see it as an elephant in the room. Let us pick it up, and thank you for your call. Neil Siegel, what about it? I mean, whatever you think on this, states' rights were certainly a very big deal. If you go back to Brown versus the Board of Education, back to the Civil Rights era, states' rights were constantly thrown up in opposition to the country moving forward on those issues.
Well, I'm profoundly grateful to Robert for calling in and making the contribution he just did, because as this conversation is unfolding, the exact phrase he used, which is elephant in the room, has been reverberating in my mind, that it's been a concern of mine that we talk about race before the end of the hour. I am concerned. One has to be careful here about just throwing accusations around, and I think there's plenty of good faith opposition to health care that doesn't have to do with race, but it is concerning to me to hear the language of states' rights, nullification, secession, when for the first time in American history we have an African-American in the White House, when under the previous administration we had a very large expansion of the federal government, and you did not hear such talk. It concerns me even more when folks like Newt Gingrich, who many Republicans regard as intellectual leader of the party, right, say that Obama and the Democrats will pay for this health care bill the way Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats paid for civil rights legislation. Now, my understanding is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is widely regarded as one of the most important statutes Congress ever passed. And so to criticize it as politically unwise or as something that deserves payback makes me concerned. The ugliness that spills over at the healthcare rallies on Capitol Hill and what John Lewis was subjected to makes me concerned. When people criticize the healthcare bill as affirmative action on steroids, it makes me concerned. Now, this does not make out a case, right, that this is all about race or primarily about race, right? But it doesn't seem to me that race is irrelevant here. It also seems to me that if we had President Palin, right, or even President McCain, you would not be having the same sort of of conversation.
We've got more callers on this front, if I may.
But, Tom, this is such a sensitive issue, though.
I think I've got at least
30 seconds on this. I mean, I think it's true that the neoconservatives who have completely taken over the conservative movement couldn't have cared less about the growth of government under George W. Bush. That's true. But that does not mean that a lot of these previously apolitical people coming out of the woodwork in these tea parties are all vicious, inconsistent, evil people. Some of them just haven't thought through their positions clearly. What they're frustrated about is no matter which party you vote for, you get the bailouts whether you want them or not. No matter which party you vote for, you get the wars whether you want them or not. And if you want to look at an issue that disproportionately affects the races, look at this foreign policy of this out-of-control government. Look at the drug war and what it does to black communities. There's a federal policy. There's our great wise protector giving us the drug war and ruining black communities. No state can opt out of that, apparently, because that would cause the earth to break free of its axis. The fact is blacks are moving on net and have been for the past couple of decades to the south. It is not Birmingham 1963 anymore, and a lot of Americans are tired of the presumption that they must hate blacks and there are only a few people in this country who are pure enough that they love everybody.
I don't think anybody wants to go with presumption here, but we all have our eyes wide open trying to see what's going on. Let's get Kristen in Moncton, Vermont. Kristen, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess my question just surreptitiously goes on top of the other one a little that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If it was left up to the states, I'd like to ask the professors, you know, how long would it have taken for civil rights to be enacted in the entire country? I mean, there's no one has a crystal ball. Or you know, women getting the vote. Those were federal issues, I believe, that, as you just discussed, occurred. And you know,
how long would it have taken without federal action on those?
Without federal action. And the other was to address a caller who called about 10 minutes ago, who said, you know, he feels that his freedom is impinged by this bill. Well, you know, if he doesn't get insurance and gets in a car accident, God forbid, you know, someone's going to have to help pay for his coverage because that would be a very expensive bill. He would, you know, I could say that my freedoms then would be
infringed upon at that point. We hear it, Kristen. I thank you very much for your call. Neil, Kristen says, you know, how long would it have taken for all the states to have civil rights if there weren't federal action then?
I think it's a good point. I think civil rights is an example of an issue, both with respect to African-Americans, other racial minorities, women, in which it's appropriate for the federal government to intervene. And if we're going to go back to the Jeffersonian tradition, I'd like to understand how the modern scope of civil rights protections is constitutional. I'd like to know how Social Security is constitutional. Federal laws protecting the environment is constitutional, right? Medicare and Medicaid is constitutional. It's not just this health care bill, right? If we're going to go back to the Jeffersonian, at least before he was president, view of congressional power, right? It's not just civil rights. It just seems to me the modern world would be unrecognizable in America.
On the other hand, if I may, Professor Siegel, were you concerned? Let's look at these other issues out there just a little bit. I mean, the use of medical marijuana. 14 states allow its use, but there's a federal prohibition. That law's been upheld in the U.S. Supreme Court. Did that bother you as an act of nullification?
Any talk of nullification bothers me because it's talk of lawlessness. Talk about whether it's beyond the scope of federal power, right, is a distinct question. I actually think the Raich case, the medical marijuana case, was correctly decided. And what you see is a switch back and forth from Democratic to Republican administrations about their understanding of federal drug law and whether it ought to apply in cases when states allow medical marijuana. The Bush administration disagreed with the Clinton administration, and now the Obama administration has changed course once again. So the idea of nullification has zero basis in modern constitutional law. You're not going to find a court in the land, or at least a federal court in the land, that's going to say, yes, states have a constitutional power of nullification, and it exists somewhere in the Constitution.
Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Kyle. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
It's fantastic. I want to make a political point. The two big things in the bill that just passed are, A, you can't be denied coverage based on pre-existing condition, and
yep.
B, the individual mandate. Now, let's go down a hypothetical situation. If the individual mandate goes away because one of these cases gets upheld by the Constitution,
yep.
then that breaks the system, and it breaks the private insurance market. And where does that lead us? It leads us to a public option, a single-payer system, because there's no politician willing to campaign on the idea of giving insurance companies the liberty to deny you based on pre-existing conditions.
Kyla, our time is short, but let us pick it up. Thomas Woods, just practically speaking, I guess you can't really have no denial of coverage if you don't have a mandate that everybody's in on it. It just wouldn't work economically. Kyle's suggesting that, you know, this could end up bringing people back to a public option or universal coverage in the end.
Yeah, it seems like either the whole package makes a certain coherent, macabre sense. I mean, it wouldn't work. Well, in that obviously it's meant to destroy the insurance companies. How can you have insurance companies have charge everybody the same premium? Well, in that case, I mean, it's like asking – I don't mean to be callous here, but frankly, it's like getting fire insurance on a burning building. I mean, an insurance company can't do that. A welfare agency can. And if that's what we want, we should just establish a welfare agency for health. We shouldn't go through the charade of saying that these are private companies and then forcing them to adopt a business model that'll drive them into the ground.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but Kyle may be onto something, Neil, that if some pieces of this get chipped away, the whole thing, as Thomas Wood says, is not likely to work. We'll end up somewhere else.
Right. And then, you know, you could possibly – it might be politically. I'm not sure how it would go. A lot will depend on future elections. But you could have a public – a government-funded public option. And if Social Security is constitutional, no one's challenging that anymore, then that would be constitutional. And if that's constitutional, why isn't the present law?
Well, there we are, right back in the big debate on the back of health care reform. I'm grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. Thomas Woods at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, a libertarian think tank, joining us from Auburn, Alabama. Mr. Woods, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Neil Siegel, professor of law and political science at Duke University. Great to have you with us today, Professor Siegel. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. Online at onpointradio.org. Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.